And we will endeavor to understand what has passed and imagine what is to come.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Now, here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial, everyone. The schedule has been rejigged for tonight. Ramsey Paul is ill, so that meant that I had to change some things around, and Keith Woods very kindly agreed to step in his place. So Keith has been on, I think, twice before Millennial, and he's due to appear in the Irish Banquet later in a few days' time as well. But Keith, welcome back to Millennial.
Yeah, it's good to be back. I said before we started, I like being the surprise guest. It's cool to be the kind of first reserve, so this should be good.
Thank you. So I'll just begin by asking the same questions that I've asked everyone. What kind of year did you think this was?
Well, there was an article in the Financial Times a couple of days ago saying that the year in a word is remigration. And it was talking about the fact that opposition to ethnic and racial diversity has been mainstreamed in a way it never was before. So, I mean, from that perspective, for the kind of things we talk about, I mean, that's huge progress. And that's the front there has been progress on in terms of if you go on social media now, I mean, your feed will quickly be inundated with this stuff if you're anyways kind of right of center in terms of opposition to immigration, remigration. You have these more casual content creators that reach a more general audience, people like Michael McCarthy blowing up. Nick Fuentes' stuff has absolutely blown up in the last year to a very casual, even apolitical audience. And a lot of the things that, 10 years ago, you wouldn't dream of in terms of the mainstreaming of some of these ideas. I mean, Elon Musk's Twitter, even in the last couple of weeks, is just like nonstop posting about, anti-white racism, and he's endorsing remigration, all these kinds of things. So, a lot of the trends that have been going in a good direction for the last 2-3 years continue to accelerate. Obviously, the frustration is, when is this going to translate into real political change? In that sense, the Trump presidency is interesting. It was actually a little bit better than I expected on that front in terms of, they did divert billions of dollars towards this deportation attempt. The southern border has basically been secured. And again, in terms of those kinds of, metapolitical or cultural shifts, like you have official White House accounts and the DHS posting about remigration and all I want for Christmas is mass deportation. So it is kind of funny to see, rather than it being confined to the internet, to see that translate somewhat into the real world. But obviously, we're still a long, long way from what's needed, especially in Europe. And there is still a disconnect. I mean, I've never bought this thing about, the internet isn't real life, and what's happening and the online discourse has no effect on the real world. But certainly, there's a very big gap between where the kind of politicized right wing people that are online following this stuff are now, and where the general public are. And in terms of the people that are political and right wing, basic standard of nationalism or ethno-nationalism in terms of, your most milquetoast conservative now will endorse mass deportations, net zero or close the border, at the very least, extreme opposition to, political Islam in the West, these kinds of things. They've all moved quite far to the right, and anyone below a certain age that you find in right-wing politics is pretty much with us. But again, the frustration and I guess the big question for the future is in what shape, in what way will that translate into real world politics and, real meaningful change that will actually reverse these things?
Yeah, that's a good summary. I think you raise a good point about, well, many good points, but one of them is the distance, because it occurs to me that, and maybe I'm reading Germany wrong, but it seems to me that Germany is sort of, is on course. I'm not going to say it's destined, but I'll say it's on course to quite radically change. And you know, with the AfD getting and probably getting into power in 5 or 8 years' time, I can't remember when the elections are. And what that means is that Britain, and meantime America, we're talking about mass deportation. But then you've got Starmer in Britain, and I don't want to get too hung up on, you know, how much of a robot he is and all of that, because it's been said many times. What interests me is, it seems to me that I could almost imagine Sweden, France, Germany, America going for mass deportations, going for remigration, and Britain being this outlier in remaining fossilized and still trying to go for the same bullshit paradigm that has defined the last 20 years since New Labour, really. I could see them still not giving up on trans, not giving up on gay stuff, not giving up on drag queen story hour, not giving up on diversity as our strength, not giving up on multiculturalism. Now, and of course, mass importation of Afghanis and Africans and so forth. Now, obviously, I hope that isn't the case, but the way things look just now with the political culture in Britain, the Westminster bubble and the media, it seems that they still believe in all of this stuff. I mean, it seems like there's no move to actually change. Well, what do you think? Do you think that's like, am I caricaturing or do you think that's accurate?
No, I think that's correct. I mean, I feel the same way about Ireland as well, in terms of it's just like it really is in kind of a bubble. I wrote an article that was published in Chronicles magazine this month about why Ireland is so left-wing, kind of pushing back against some of the memes of like, oh, you know, Google came in and made everything leftist or something like this, or, you know, it's because Irish people are third worldist, these kinds of memes. But to me, the big thing is just how coherent and centered the state class or the managerial class is in a small pocket of Dublin. It's just all the incentives are for that kind of bureaucratic managerial class to be extremely conformist, and then they have all this means that they're they have all this means to, you know, force the country along with that, in terms of there's no real competing power centers geographically or financially. You know, there isn't really like a big business lobby to push back against the government, any of this kind of thing that you have in some countries, language or ethnic divisions. And so you really get this kind of fossilized, like, it's very like early 2000s, like Obama type Democrat politics. You know, they all love the Democrats in the US. And it always feels like it's 10, 20 years behind the continent, and they're still fully embracing, you know, wokeness.
Scotland's the same. Scotland's exactly the same. It's like a museum.
when you watch mainstream media, for me anyway, like the current affairs and news programs, I mean, they are going further to the left. It's very bizarre. And certainly the public is talking more about immigration issues and so on. But this little state class are so in their bubble that they don't realize, they don't see any downsides in that, and just pushing things further left and going further off into this bubble. But they are losing a large percentage of the population as they do this. I think I cut you off there.
No, I was just going to bring in a humorous analogy. I remember, you know, the soap opera Neighbours, the Australian soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, in the, I don't know, I used to watch that when I was a kid, and at one point I was in Denmark on holiday, this is in the early 90s, and they were showing old episodes from like 5 years earlier, and it was characters who had died and disappeared and all the rest of it. And it was these old storylines playing out. And I was just reminded of that when I was thinking of how Scotland and Ireland seem compared with everywhere else in Europe. I mean, they're still saying the same buzzwords, the same catchphrases, and the same presuppositions about every aspect of life, when everyone else has moved on from that. It's this very strange Groundhog Day, I guess, where it just the past is endlessly repeating. And as you say, that I think in the case of Ireland, that's a plausible explanation for why it's like that. I think in the case of Scotland, it's just that they're constantly defining themselves against England, and they believe that England is a far right, you know, conservative, capitalistic, racist, homophobic, transphobic society. Therefore, Scotland has to be the opposite of all of those things, and that's the impetus. And they tell, you know, the SNP and so on will tell that stuff to their supporters, to the general public. And I guess enough of them believe it in order for this, for all of this to be sustained.
Yeah, the media do the very same thing here in terms of the last few years. All you hear about is how, you know, essentially Britain is on a wrong course because of Brexit and because people got misled by charlatans like Farage. And, you know, every problem Britain has is essentially because of either some latent Thatcherism or else because they just can't see past their... they can't see past these demagogues like Farage. And of course, you know, they can compare their own achievements and say, look how successful we are compared to this by sticking the course and so on. So it's a kind of a useful narrative for them because they can still, you know, they can tap into some kind of sense of patriotism or opposition to England. But I mean, I guess in terms of your question, what's the limit to that? Like what's Farage, Starmer is as bad as ever, and people are still being thrown in jail for memes, and you know, the country is still on course to become majority non-white. I mean, it seems like on present trends anyway, I mean, it seems like Reform will win the next election. Obviously there's a lot that could happen between now and then, and you know, the system will, I'm sure, cook up some kind of shenanigans in terms of some kind of great leftist voting pack to try and tactically take away Reform seats, and you know, of course the media will throw everything at them, but hasn't been very successful so far. But you know, that's going to be an interesting scenario because Farage is going to kind of be elected by that latent like boomer patriotism or boomer reactionary sentiment of people that aren't really, you know, they're not really, you know, you couldn't even call them properly right wing, I think, but it is the kind of reaction to, you know, wokeness and especially the boats, you know, the illegal immigrants, the extent of that, and implicitly as well the demographic change. But of course, you know, even if you take him at his word, he's not going to do anything really to reverse that. You know, he has reluctantly promised mass deportations after saying for a long time that they weren't politically feasible, but that's just of the illegal immigrants. So the demographic change continues. But I mean, what he could do, and I think it's possible to imagine Reform repealing a lot of the hate speech things, a lot of the things that are landing people in jail, pulling back some of the kind of human rights law and some of the things that constrain populist politics in Britain. I think that would change the dynamics in terms of how people approach politics in the UK. So in a sense, I mean, you could say like on the continent, a lot of the political establishment has reversed things a little bit. Like I think Denmark and Sweden are good examples of like they still have pretty leftist governments, but technically they have remigration platforms. You know, it's voluntary. Not many people take it up. But Denmark is like, it's a very technocratic kind of scientific socialist government. And they very kind of autistically looked at the immigration issue and just said, well, okay, you know, this causes problems. You know, we have this data on social trust and problems diversity. And also, we don't really want a big far right like they have in some of these countries. You know, we kind of like having this big center-left consensus. So we'll just kind of technically manage immigration. We went too far in a few places. We'll reverse that a little bit. We'll put some limits on that. And it has succeeded in terms of it. There isn't really a big nationalist movement there. There isn't really a big upstart populist thing. And, you know, they're not as far along in terms of the demographic replacement, but it's not ideologically nationalist. So there's different degrees to which governments in Europe are kind of being dragged to that position of, like, you know, you can have an AFD on 25% and you don't really know what they're going to do in government, and you're concerned that maybe half their ranks are secretly, you know, ethno-nationalists that want to, like, overthrow the liberal system. Or you can just make a lot of concessions you're not really comfortable with and just enforce immigration law properly, and kind of piss off your more woke far-left supporters. And, you know, the UK, and I would say Ireland as well, is a case where the establishment has chosen not to go with that reformist route and to very steadfastly stick to this is the program, and anyone that criticizes it from the right is a far right, you know, fascist that has no place in the conversation. But I think you see with the Tory wipeout and now the potential Labour wipeout, the downside of that is you kick the can down the road, and eventually, you know, the kind of normie sort of boomer voters, eventually they might find someone like Farage and reform that pops up. And you can have, like, your two-party system wiped out in two elections. So it's like, you know, it's kind of an internal, I guess, debate between the establishment of how do you go along with this replacement process. And, you know, if reform end up with a huge majority and Labour and the Conservative Party are knocked into being minor parties, I mean, that's a pretty good argument that actually all of these governments should be following the Danish route much more closely.
Yeah, it's a question of giving the electorate what they want, or at least a bit of what they want, so that they won't go ideologically in that direction. But I think in the case of Britain and many, certainly Germany, it's just too late for that now. Denmark, I don't know what the numbers are with their population. Here is one study from Denmark. I brought this up while you were talking about it, and this shows the economic, I mean, it's disastrous, the economic effect of mass immigration. And it's exactly as you would expect. White people are the two blue lines. And then I guess you've got probably, well, it's Middle East. What's that? I can't remember what MENAP stands for, actually. Middle East, North Africa.
And Turkey. I don't know what PT is.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Pakistan and Turkey. So they're the lowest economically. And then the other line, I don't know what, it's just other non-Western immigrants. So basically, white people are the most economically productive by a long way. It's astonishing, actually, when you, that difference. I mean, the men, look at that. The Middle East, North Africa, Pakistan and Turkey are a net fiscal drain throughout their entire life. There is no point in their life where they are economically beneficial to the country. That is an astonishing summary and an amazing fact, because it just completely rubbishes the argument. Well, it not so much all of the arguments for immigration, because you could still say, okay, they're making us poorer, but they're enriching us culturally. But it definitely rubbishes the economic argument. And as for the other non-Western immigrants, there's really not much. I mean, between 20 and 55, they're mildly beneficial, and then the rest of their lives, they're a drain economically. So that's just disastrous. As a picture, if that was what civic nationalist, open borders people if they were hoping to make the economic case, I think at least in the case of Denmark, they just can't. it's terrible. So I think that might have accelerated that move in Denmark among the non-ideological parties to do it just for economic reasons alone. I don't know.
Yeah, there was a similar study that came out of the Netherlands, I think just in the last couple of years. And I mean, it's pretty much identical in terms of the net fiscal drain of non-European migrants. I seem to remember for one category, it might have been just non-Westerners, non-whites in general. It was something like a net fiscal drain in the lifetime of one of these immigrants going into six figures, around 100,000 euros. So when you actually break it down, it's quite incredible. And a lot of the stuff I see lately in terms of, you'll see some of these people on Twitter that make good charts of like breakdowns of crime by ethnicity and so on. A lot of it actually comes from Denmark because they're one of the very few countries that just put this stuff out there in terms of like, you know, again, this very like autistic approach of like, well, okay, here's all of the like ethnic data on our prisons and who's committing what crime and what the financial contribution is and so on. So, yeah, it's an interesting, you know, it's an interesting case because, like I said, there still isn't really a national populist right there as far as I can tell. But for whatever reason, they've decided to take this very honest approach with diversity and its effects.
Yeah. Yeah, I found the one from the Netherlands as well. See, it's good to have a well-organized meme folder because these things can be useful in streams. And so this is, as you said, very much the same picture. It's only for first-generation immigrants, but it's dreadful. It's just dreadful for the non-Western.
Well, I remember, I'm trying to remember which country this data was from, but I remember seeing that actually for the second and third generation immigrants, it might have even been that Danish one, they're actually a bigger drain than the first generation immigrants. In other words, the trend got worse for non-Western immigrants. Like their parents tended to work more, be on welfare less, you know, just generally be better members of society, lower crime rates. Which kind of makes sense as well. There's kind of a selection pressure there in terms of, you know, the first generation immigrant that's desperate to get to the West and maybe, you know, appreciates Western civilization to some degree and appreciates the fruits of Western civilization, you know, versus their children who may be more delinquent. And there's also, you know, there's also this trend of like reversion to the mean in IQ as well, where you may have a selection of higher IQ migrants in the first generation, but then you have a, you know, the if there's like an exceptional outlier, it will kind of disappear over a generation or two. So
yeah,
a lot of the, you know, a lot of the myths people might have in their mind about assimilation and so on, actually the data shows it very much goes in the opposite direction.
Yeah. I remember somebody saying a few years ago that all of this is known in the social sciences. It's only a matter of time before it gets out, and it's going to trash all of the common arguments. So that would be regression to the mean in terms of IQ, regression in terms of their economic contribution, and their general economic. I mean, even for the first generation,
in terms of all this being known,
everything is fake. All of these myths are being exploded. Sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, and another one, in terms of all of this being known, and again, to tie it to Denmark, there's a 2021 study from the University of Copenhagen that's really interesting from our perspective. It's a meta-analysis of every study ever done in sociology on the relationship between diversity and social trust. It's like 91 studies, and it's like overwhelming. It's like 89 out of 91, there's a strong trend between diversity going up and social trust going down. And of course, with social trust, which is this marker that's used in sociology, you know, as that declines, basically everything gets worse. You know, you have more crime, you have more graffiti on your public buildings, you know, people trust their neighbors less, they go out less, they contribute less to charities, they're less politically engaged, you know, they tend to be more depressed, individualistic, all these negative trends, basically all the things you want to avoid for a functioning society. So this is, you know, attested to over tens of studies, different countries, different decades, again and again, sociology professors have found that diversity basically makes everything worse, and there's no counter study. There isn't even one in the opposite direction. So that is, in terms of like, if you treat sociology as a science, in terms of social sciences, that's like settled science. You know, that's like gravity. That's like a very basic thing that's been attested to again and again. And yet, you know, I studied sociology in university, and yet every sociology professor is an absolute raging leftist communist that loves diversity. So there you go.
I wonder if there's any explanation for that. They just don't read at a high level of their own literature. I don't know. I'm not saying that. I just don't. It's amazing. But it does seem to be borne out. I mean, everyone knows about the stereotype of the sociology professor who's just an absolute raving Marxist. And yet sociology is discovering these truths about human nature that a lot of people have been saying for a long time. To get back to the main thing, we seem to be in this transitional moment where certain truths are known and are just waiting to explode into the discourse, and also where the discourse itself is changing. And then that leaves our politicians sort of flailing. And I do think they're flailing. I do think it's quite genuine. I think they don't know how to react to this. A big part of this, and we've talked about this before, the last time you were on, is Elon Musk taking over X, because that, I think, it's like if you wanted one single thing that signaled the death knell for legacy media, it would be that moment. Because up till then, there was still a lot of... these old companies, these old TV companies, had outlets online. And I think that X, Twitter, has really just trashed them in the last year or so. Apparently, it is now the most popular news source on in Britain, X. Mm. So that's one. I don't want to get too fixated on that. It's just a point that's worth mentioning here. I think that the question is, as always, what are the politicians going to do? How are they going to react to this change that is very clearly happening? I think they're flailing. I think they're scared. At least the more aware of them are. I mean, a lot of politicians aren't very bright, frankly, and they'll be quite oblivious to some of this. But everyone is talking about, well, Trump, Fuentes, Tucker Carlson, Piers Morgan, Candace Owens even. And it used to be that these were all just hideous liars, bogeymen, nutters, fake news merchants and all that. And now I don't think you can get away with, you can't just dismiss them like that anymore.
No, certainly not. I mean, the degree to which Candace Owens has captured like popular support among like middle-aged like moms that are like into true crime podcasts, like it's like not a typically political audience at all, is her audience. And then she's brought apparently millions of them into this. You know, her podcast is one of the most popular podcasts of any kind in the world. You know, Tucker Carlson's another example, someone that left mainstream media and is probably, I would say, far more influential, at least in terms of his reach, than when he was on Fox News. And yeah, I mean, Nick Fuentes, again, that's a case where, you know, the kitchen sink was thrown at him in terms of censorship. And we might have had this conversation in 2020, 2021, and said there's kind of a hard ceiling there in terms of, well, if you're banned off every platform, and, you know, TikTok was banned in searching his name, and you couldn't upload clips of his stream to YouTube. I mean, that really establishes a hard ceiling. But just the nature of the internet and the way people have found to get around that on platforms, and the growth of short form content, and just how quickly things spread memetically now, you know, he's totally destroyed that. It's, you know, the extent of his reach just being on Rumble is kind of unprecedented in terms of the way it spreads on other platforms. So yeah, it's a very different dynamic. And you know, the concern would be that the response will come from governments then. And we've seen that a little bit with the Digital Services Act from the EU. The online safety bill from the UK is one of the worst, I think. And you even have Google this week came out speaking out against that, saying this is terrible. You know, Britain is suppressing freedom of speech. And it's like, wow, you know, Google of all people after all these years.
Yeah.
Really cares about freedom of speech. Yeah, but, you know, even that, though, I mean, as grim as that is, that's also a thing I look at where it's like, well, if Farage and Reform get into power in a few years, I mean, you know, he's tight with Trump and Vance and Musk and those guys. And, like, they're one of their top priorities is freeing up Europe for the American social media platforms. So I would imagine something like that would be repealed as well. And, you know, you've had J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio making quite strong statements against the EU over this censorship. They were even introducing or they were scrapping some kind of free trade agreement a couple of weeks ago on the basis that the EU wasn't being consistent in upholding freedom of speech. So, you know, there's at least a kind of counter there, you know, even if we're not fully with Trump or, you know, Peter Thiel or Vance, whatever, there's at least a counter there in terms of, you know, they may not want like ethno-nationalists in power or whatever, but they certainly want the kind of freedom of speech they have in the US to operate in Europe. I think that's clear in terms of their behavior and in terms of how it's just affecting the bottom line of some of these platforms now. So, yeah, there is a political space for that to be reversed. I mean, the weird thing is, as much as we hit on boomers, like in a weird way, if you look at the polling on this, it's in some ways it's kind of scary. It's like boomers and Gen X are kind of saving free speech for us, you know, in terms of the people that still believe in like classical liberal principles of, you know, say what you want as long as you're not advocating violence and these kinds of ideas that are much more popular in the US, unfortunately. But that's really felt among boomers and Gen X. And a lot of the, you know, a lot of the backlash to wokeism kind of came from, you know, sort of Gen X centrists, people like Elon Musk and a lot of these tech bros. And you're kind of seeing a backlash there where there was an activist millennial class that got a little carried away. But, you know, the boomers, the Gen Xers still have the wealth and the assets and kind of flex their muscle a bit. So the weird thing is there's kind of like two trends where these people kind of have the wind behind their sails and have the potential to reverse a lot of this stuff politically. But then you look at Poland and it's like a vast majority of Gen Z are like, yeah, it should be okay to like throw someone in jail if they offend a minority. So it's like a short, medium term positive trend, and then long term, like, oh my God, what are we gonna do when these people are the dominant majority?
I think by then things will have changed so much that I don't see them sticking to that line. I think they'll, I mean, we're talking about people who are, I guess, 15 to what, 25, 27. I don't know how old the oldest Zoomer is now, but it's our countries are going to continue transforming at least in the next 5 years. Before mass deportation happens, if it does happen, but let's assume it's not going to happen immediately. So they're going to continue seeing this. Let's talk about the Zoomers. I don't know if you technically are a Zoomer, but I guess it doesn't really matter that much.
I'm just on the borderline. I'm a 95 gang. Apparently the cutoff is 96. So.
Ah, right. Okay.
I guess I'm a Zillennial.
Well, what would you say about this, because I don't know if you have any particular grasp of this, but one, there's the myth that the Zoomers are hard right if they're men, but the women are insane, like communists. Do you think that's true?
Well, from the polling, I mean, the majority, Zoomers are more left-wing than other generations, right? That's the first thing in terms of the base Zoomer thing is actually it does just get more leftist the lower you go in generation. So there's nuance to that as well, because you can say, well, okay, boomers overall might, you know, they might support Trump more, they might be more socially conservative, but like every right-wing boomer is like a, you know, an Israel fanatic that like loves the idea of like, you know, black people waving his national country's flag and this kind of thing. So there's some nuance there, but just in terms of like, you know, how they profess their beliefs on various issues, Zoomers are the most left-wing, but it's the, you know, the kind of one third of them that are right wing rather than one half. That one third is much more towards identitarianism than conservatism. You know, the kind of post-war kind of Christian conservatism, center right, like CDU in Germany, the Tories in the UK, you know, the Ronald Reagan stuff. I mean, that's basically dead among young people. All of the kind of, you know, free to choose, Milton Friedman, all the stuff about, you know, free markets and socialism sucks. I mean, it just, no one cares about that. It doesn't resonate with anyone. I remember when Charlie Kirk used to post that stuff and he like dropped it after a year. It's like, okay, this actually isn't really going to help me get the young people on my side. So if you're right wing now, I mean, it's basically for identitarian reasons. I mean, that may be religious reasons, but you could call that a kind of identitarianism, in that they're you know, they're grouping together with people that share their disgust to certain issues, or their, you know, their principled opposition to things like abortion. So it's a much more identitarian grouping on fundamental issues, and they're basically, like I said earlier, I mean, they're basically all on board with some basic level of nationalism and opposition to immigration now. So that's kind of the positive trend there. The thing of the divergence between male and female, that's very real as well. And that's borne out by all sorts of polls and voting patterns. And I think it's happening in other generations to an extent. And it started happening especially around the start of the 2010s and a bit after, which I guess would be the growth of social media especially. But yeah, if you look at the trends, and especially in the last few years, like post-2020, post-BLM, you'll see, like, if you've a pink and a blue line to represent them, they're kind of next to each other. And then 2020-ish, they just go off in different directions. And yeah, the young men started watching Nick Fuentes, and the young women, I guess, you know, where do leftists get their content from now? Like Hassan or something like that. But yeah, they're very much going in opposite directions. And that seems to be a trend that's just, every time I see a new poll on that, it seems to be getting worse every year. So that's kind of an interesting trend.
Yeah, it definitely is, because I mean, again, what's it going to result in? How is it going to resolve? Is it just going to be that men and women are living in different universes, and well, that lower the birth rate even further? Or is it going to be that people, and you could could be any number of scenarios, the men just cuck because they want sex, or the women align with the men because they want marriage, or they want stability, or they want security. I mean, these are the stereotypical things that women want from men. I suspect it might be a case of whoever can hold out the longest will get what they want. I mean, behind every e-thought is 1,000 men willingly being her pay pigs. So, you know, we can moan about that, but it's ultimately men who allow and enable that to happen. And I think in a similar way, if men tolerate this kind of nonsense from women, then it will just continue. If they can hold out long enough, that will force a lot of women to align with them politically. But, I mean, how could you orchestrate that? You just couldn't, really. I do think that the loss of security that would come from some sort of societal breakdown would obviously make this happen. The women would just, they wouldn't have, there would be no debate. They would just need security, and feminism would be out the window. But short of that happening, I don't know how this changes. It's sort of intractable.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in the very long run, you can look at the birth rate trends in the way that Edward Dutton or Eric Kaufman do and say, you know, in the long run, as you have a birth rate collapse, which we have everywhere now, suddenly who's having the kids matters a lot more. You know, if a time when everyone is having seven kids, it's whatever. But now when it's like the birth rate is 1.3 or 1.4, and there's subsections of the population where they're all having 5-6 children in just a generation or two, I mean, that could really, really flip things. Dutton's book, The Past, the Future Country, he did some interesting projections on that where he's like, you know, 5% of the population are radical leftists. And on, you know, based on the projections he did, it's like in 2-3 generations, it'll be like a fraction of a percent. So very, very quickly things can change. And that, I mean, that's one thing that's kind of unique about this time now is like suddenly you have very weird, unique selection pressures where the way we're talking about the divergence between men and women, it's like politics has become a part of people's identity in a way I think it wasn't before. You know, you always hear this from boomers as well. Like, you know, we'd argue about politics, but at the end of the day, you got to, whoever the president is, whoever the guy in charge is, then you got to support him absolutely, right? And you go country first. I mean, and that's pretty much gone. And it is kind of an identity marker now. And what you're talking about there, you know, there are liberal women that won't talk to or consider right-wing guys and vice versa. So there's a sorting going on there. But obviously, if you look at the trends in birth rates, you know, the very liberal people are not having a lot of children for various reasons, just for their own psychological makeup. The kind of psychology that makes someone leftist is also the psychology that makes someone not want to have children. And then, of course, there's just political reasons as well, right? They'll be concerned about climate change or, you know, they'll
yeah.
believe ideologically in feminism, so choose to spend years pursuing work and so on, and they're just kind of, you know, just believe a lot of fantasies in terms of, you know, how having children works and how long they can defer that for and so on. And then people that are, you know, quite ideologically committed to family values and reproducing and so on. So I think that's kind of a new trend, and it might not seem like a big deal now because, I mean, it's still like, okay, we're talking about all this, but still, I mean, what, maybe 5 to 10% of the population are very political and, you know, will make serious life choices on the basis of politics. And most people just kind of go along and kind of see bits of news here and there on TikTok or something, and this is all just noise. But again, when you have a very stark birth rate collapse in a few generations, you can see real transformations there. And it's always, you know, it's always radicals, it's always minorities that really drive politics and history. And, you know, suddenly those people have a big differential in terms of their birth rates. It makes for interesting potential scenarios, because what's the end to that, right? Like, we've had a norm throughout history where, you know, the selection pressures were, you know, the kind of limit of poverty that was there, and then we overcame that with technological progress and so on, and everyone had as many kids as they wanted to, and now we're at kind of the tail end of that process of liberal modernity where people just, they can have as many kids as they want, but they just choose not to and just kind of apathetically die out. And so now this new process is kicking in where you have selection pressures for people that have pronatal values. And you know, the question is like, well, is there another process after that, in the same way there was another process after, like, okay, boom, it's the Industrial Revolution, we can all have 10 kids, and now we're in this process, but is there another process after this? And it's hard to really think of that. I mean, the state isn't going to come in and say, no, we can't have you Mormons, like, becoming, you know, a quarter of the population of the United States, like, you guys can only have 2 kids each or something. I mean, that's not going to happen. I don't think the liberal state would even have it in it to go about doing that, right? And it would really invalidate the kind of fundamental premises of even what leftists believe to try and start managing people in that way. At least that's what I think. So, yeah, so there's no end to that. So, you know, again, in our lifetime, even, we may not see this to a huge degree. I mean, we'll see fewer extreme leftists. But... you know, what does that process look like generations after us? I don't see how that ends.
No, indeed. Something else you mentioned earlier was well, I'll use my own wording, the death of mainstream conservatism. And you alluded to this, that people are now right-wing for identitarian reasons, not for economic reasons, not for values and principles as such, but and liberty, but because they're worried, well, they're identifying with their ethnic group. I said this for years about libertarianism, that it appeals to a certain type of white guy, Spergy. It sounds good. It just sounds like a solution. Sounds like a blueprint and all that, but it doesn't give you anything that you can latch onto and care about. And it doesn't spell except liberty, but liberty is it's like a placeholder for anything else. Which again, you might say, well, that's great. That's why it's so flexible. So many people can get what they want from libertarianism. But actually, it's still nothing. It's still not something that people will fight for because it's not some tangible thing. And I think conservatism finds itself in the same position where nobody really knows what's being conserved. Nobody really knows what the conservative is supposed to care about, except the economy. But then even that's murky because, again, conservatives have overseen the last 20 years, at least in Britain, and the last 15 years, and the economy is a disaster. So, yeah, in America, the myth is always that, well, the Dems get in and they ruin the economy, and then the Republicans get in and they put things right. But I don't know if that's true either. Maybe it is true, but I don't know. Either way, the economy is sort of irrelevant to a lot of people now because of the demographics and because in every other way, so modern society isn't working for them. So there is just no use for the conservative today. What would you say about that?
Yeah, and I mean, the other economic dimension to that is, like, you know, conservatives are appealing to homeowners and asset owners and you know, saying we'll steady the ship and we'll deliver you a few percentage points of growth every year, and your assets will go up and your stock portfolio will go up, and you know, we won't do anything too crazy. We won't hyperinflate the currency or you know, tax your gains too much. But it's like, now you're talking to a generation that doesn't own anything, and, you know, don't even save for the future, because it's like, well, you know, when I'm 60, like, either it'll be like a Mad Max scenario or like money won't exist and we'll be like post-scarcity with AI, so who even cares? And like, don't even consider it a realistic prospect that they'll own a house in their 30s. So it's like, at that point, what's really the pitch of you know, a kind of Tory conservative party? Like, what, like, you can like save up money and then maybe your parents will like help you get a deposit for a mortgage, and by the time you're in your late 30s, you can like get a house surrounded by Pakistanis. It's like very, it's like at least, you know, in the 60s, 70s, you were living through this unprecedented period of growth, and the stock market was going up, and, you know, there was all these new markets opening up on the world stage, and the sense that things could just go up and up. Now it's just like, well, you know, hopefully AI will just like nuke the debt out of orbit and give us post-scarcity economics, and we won't have to pay off this mountain of economic debt and actually deal with all these economic problems. But yeah, it's like the younger generation just don't care. I mean, this stuff, you know, none of this stuff is resonant. Like, and I think Peter Thiel, I think, wrote something about this a few years ago. I forget who was in response. He was having a debate with someone about why, like, what do we do about the growth of socialism in America, basically? And what do rich people like us do about that? Like, how do we combat this? Or what's the problem? Like, why is everyone becoming so damn left-wing? And, you know, Peter Thiel, I think, made a correct point, which is like, well, you know, the thing about capitalism is it's like, it's a good system because you can own stuff and you can trade and you can, you know, you can build wealth. Well, like, what exactly are we pitching if we're talking to a generation that doesn't own anything and like has no prospect of owning anything, and probably all they own is like a big student loan? So it's just a net negative. So yeah, at that point, like the pitch of socialism, it's like, okay, maybe you won't get the most efficient markets, and there's been a few failures in the past, but it's like, well, what do you even have to lose at that point? Like, okay, you know, screw it, let's just take wealth from the people that have it and redistribute it, you know. And that's kind of the simple pitch for the Zoran Mamdanis of the world. But yeah, at the same time, it's like, well, what are the conservatives, you know, the kind of standard center-right conservatives offering in response to that? Because, you know, there's a strong age bias as well, where all of these parties are just propped up by old people. And so they'll never, you know, any kind of populism they have is always just going to be, you know, we'll stop the left touching the pensions or touching any of the benefits for old people and so on. And it's, you know, I think a genuine populist platform, like one of the big things would be a kind of anti-gerontocratic platform of like every fiscal decision that's taken in the West basically benefits old people. And we have this totally ridiculous system where, I mean, if you were to draw up an economic system from scratch, would you have it that you like give all the wealth to the old people to enjoy at the end of their life when like their bodies are breaking down and like young people like start out with nothing and have to scratch and claw to get assets? I mean, it obviously doesn't make any sense on paper, especially considering, you know, that wasn't how it was until quite recently. And now the scales are tipped. There isn't really any way to tip them back. But again, if you look at any kind of populist force in the West, I mean, even just this year, Trump did some budgetary thing. It was part of his big, beautiful bill. And it was just like a direct wealth transfer to old people, you know, in terms of there was some analysis breaking down the big, beautiful bill. And it was like it took a few hundred dollars from young salaried workers and it gave like $6,000-$7,000 to retired boomers. And that's kind of the same everywhere in the West, you know, and even some of the populist movements in terms of like, you know, when France was protesting Macron trying to raise the retirement age and so on, like populists are always going to jump on that stuff and be like, oh, look, you know, the state is, you know, it won't even leave our great old people long to serve the country. But it's like clearly the system is totally broken and clearly it's not really a fair system that you have boomers that like, you know, have like 30 extra wealth because they bought a house in a good place at a good time. And then, you know, the UK, for example, like you have a whole generation of people that just like, you know, cheap council houses that were built by taxpayer funds were flogged off to them. And, you know, they've gone up a multiple in value. And now there's another generation that like can't buy a house or get access to public housing. It's like a totally ridiculous system. But essentially, you know, though that generation of conservative parties just went in on that voter block share and they still command a certain degree of loyalty and can still pitch them something. But they, you know, it did create a zero sum game in terms of the young versus the old. And yeah, I mean, they literally have nothing to offer younger people, even economically now.
Yeah. That's the thing, even economically. And that's become so clear over the last few years. Yeah, it's a huge problem. And you know, when I hear about the debt that we're in, like it's just the amounts are eye watering. They're inconceivable. I mean, like $1 trillion. It's exhausting to even think about it. And I think it's as you suggest, it's no one cares about it anymore because there's no way for them to get a slice of it. And in any case, the debt is so huge that there's no point even approaching it, certainly from the point of view of an ordinary person. So it's there's nothing to be done about it, in a sense. I mean, I've no idea what's actually going to happen here. Is it going to have to be paid off, or is it going to be written off? And you know, that gets us to the matter of digital money. I don't know what's going to happen there. You hear these things. It does seem like a some contingent at the elite level in Europe are up for that. They really want that, along with the digital ID and so on. But I don't know whether that is going to happen. Again, we're in such a transitional moment that it's very difficult to predict how any of these things are going to play out. I think. Do you have anything to say about digital ID and digital money?
Well, I would tie that to something else that happened this year, which was Elon Musk's Doge, and his progression on that issue is quite funny because before the election, I remember he's retweeting all this stuff, like Milton Friedman talking about the debt and, you know, we need to get the debt down and, you know, the country is doomed if we don't fix the debt after next election and so on. And then, you know, he set up Doge and he made these promises. Like, I think at some point he was promising like $2 trillion in savings. But basically he went in and quickly realized the political realities of, like, actually, you know, as much as populists talk about, you know, the huge inefficiency in the government, it turns out it's not as inefficient as they act like it is. You know, it's kind of just an easy talking point to attack the establishment. But actually, you know, the obvious stuff like the USAID, I mean, that's ideological and that was pulled and that's good. But in terms of Doge trying to find, like, you know, dead people that are still being salaried or this kind of thing, I mean, there was very little of it and they made very little savings and didn't even really publicize it for that reason. But, you know, quickly he realized if you want to make the kinds of savings he's talking about, I mean, you have to just slash Social Security, you have to slash pensions, you have to slash welfare, you have to slash healthcare. And that's just not politically viable. And that's, you know, the falling out he had with Trump and with the Republican Party is he kind of crashed out about that of like, well, no, we have to fix the debt. Look how big of a problem this is. The only way to fix it is to make serious spending cuts. And, you know, all the Republicans just kind of collectively went, well, okay, well, you know, tell us how you go and slash all of these programs and then win the next election. You know, tell us how you do this and not have the boomers that rely on this stuff completely turn on the party and kill it politically. And then what happens, right? AOC and Bernie Sanders come in and restore them and 2X them and the debt gets worse anyway. So, and he didn't have an answer to that. I mean, he promised the America Party, he promised the third party. That was kind of funny as well. You know, he's talking about like 40% of Americans or whatever it is want a third party. And then it's like, you know, you pull the public on what they want. And what do they want? Like lower taxes, more spending, more social welfare, higher pensions. Like the party coming along saying, let's like slash government spending and take away your pensions so that we can not face this looming debt crisis that is very abstract to people. It's not going to get anywhere politically. So, but it's funny because now, if you look at him, now his new position is like he kind of just quietly dropped Doge and it was blackpilled on politics for a while. And now his new position is like, well, yeah, the debt is completely unsustainable, but, you know, maybe it won't matter because if we invent artificial general intelligence, everyone will have a personal robot that can do brain surgery on them and we'll be post-scarcity and money won't matter anymore. So that's like, that was like his ultimate kind of answer to the debt problem is like, well, you know, it won't be a problem if we just like make everyone infinitely wealthy with robots, which is, you know, I think that's kind of a reach. But yeah, I mean, it's not, there is no political answer to it. I mean, I think in the long run, you know, it's hard to imagine a solution except, you know, some investors and politicians are banking on AI is going to be this new industrial revolution. It'll create such prosperity that, you know, the debt will become a small fraction of what it was in relative terms. I just don't buy that. I did a show a while back on why I think the AI thing happening right now is a bubble. And isn't going to deliver the kind of economic gains they expect. So I don't see that. So yeah, and I mean, in the long run, the only way you deal with a debt crisis is what, you just inflate the currency and that causes all manner of economic problems or you pay it off and slash spending and impoverish people. So probably going to be a devaluation of the US dollar. I mean, that would create all kinds of shocks economically, geopolitically, so on. So, but yeah, what's the alternative? It doesn't seem like anyone really has a plan there. And yeah, the digital currency, it does seem like the EU is very keen to proceed with that. You know, you said there, like, it seems like maybe it won't happen. I'm almost surprised they haven't gone further with that. There's constantly, like, hints and talk of the digital currency coming, but no real progress ever seems to be made. Like it seems like a very obvious thing for the existing state to do is like just digitize everything, wipe out the black market, you know, have the potential to track everything. Like the technology is already there with the you know, technology is already there with cryptography and the existence of cryptocurrency and so on. But yeah, very little move made on that. I wonder, is it like it's just touchy politically and it's going to give the right a lot to unite around and they just don't want the headache? Or is it some kind of logistical thing I'm just not thinking of?
It could be both. I mean, it could be that to implement this would mean changing so many systems and it would have to be pretty bulletproof as well. I mean, you can't do this and then, oh, we've just lost $1 billion here. We've lost $1 billion, whatever, digital euros there. But it's just teething problems. This is something that would have to be pretty much bulletproof from the start. And you know, the feeling I have about Europe and the EU is that it's just sclerotic at this point. I'm not surprised that if they're contemplating a massive project like this, that they just can't pull it off. And maybe they're slowly realizing it, that this is just too ambitious. It's too technocratic. And that might be why there's so little progress, but also they won't want to admit that. They'll want to stretch it out for as long as they can, hopefully so that people will forget about it and then they can just stop talking. I don't know. It's very difficult to know what's going on there, because as you say, they keep hinting at it and talking and writing documents about it. But there's no real progress. I believe, was it Estonia had some sort of pilot product? Am I getting mixed up with UBI? I can't remember. Not much tangible progress for something that seems to be key to their vision for Europe's future. But at the same time, I think that the EU is... it's playing second fiddle to America, and right now that's Trump. I don't know where he stands on digital currency. I don't know if he has any interest in it at all. I can't remember what he last said about it, but it seems like the kind of thing that he would be instinctively suspicious of. And either way, America, if America implements this, then Europe will just have to. It will just be obvious, be unavoidable. But until it happens there, I don't see it happening here.
Yeah, Ron DeSantis signed something that officially banned a central bank digital currency, which I don't really know what that means, because it's like, well, if someone replaced him and decided they wanted it, like, can't they just be like, okay, it's not banned anymore? So it seemed like kind of a symbolic thing to his supporters. Mm. Like, you know, we're laying this out, we're not having it. And I guess that's probably a part of it, is like if you have to do something across the EU, it's always sticky in terms of you need all the different member states, especially the big ones, on board with it. And then it's like, well, what if Le Pen comes along and makes hay with it politically and is against it? And then what if France turns and just, you know, yeah, like you said, dragging anything through the EU is a process. I mean, I guess the other thing is, I wrote an article a couple of years ago on the euro dollar system. That's a very interesting topic. Like trying to make sense of the kind of offshore banking system, which is kind of the real monetary system. Like, as much as people focus on central banks and the Federal Reserve and so on, like the real monetary system is this really kind of uncharted, unmonitored offshore private banking system. And I mean, that basically is a digital currency. You know, that, like, it's called the euro dollar, but it's basically, you know, it's transactions denominated in dollars done offshore, which is like the majority of financial transactions in the world pass through this system. And they also create money as well. You know, the Bank of England released a report on money creation a few years ago where it broke down in detail, like, well, look, you know, the private banks actually create money. The Bank of England doesn't really create any currency in this process. They're kind of there to incentivize this. That process has emerged, like, I guess you could say organically, but it emerged to solve problems for international bankers. And, you know, it functions quite well in terms of, you can go to you know, you can go to Turkey and withdraw from your English bank account on a Sunday night, and you know, all the banks are closed, and you get instant currency conversion into whatever it is, and it's existing exchange rates, and it's happening when people aren't there to check the exchange and so on. And this is you know, a kind of a private banker's digital currency that the whole financial system runs on. And I imagine, you know, this is a kind of behind closed doors thing, but I imagine there's a problem there of like, well, if you actually tried to make this all top down from the central governments, you'd run into a lot of problems in realizing like where some of this money creation has taken place and how this actually conflicts with like stated government policy and what that could actually do for confidence in governments and in the financial system. And yeah, like so there would be like, you know, missing billions or trillions, and like it would get very difficult to monitor, and the whole system could falter. And then, you know, it's responsible for most of the money flow in the world. You'd get huge knock on effects economically. So, you know, it may just be that quietly, you know, the private bankers have kind of figured out a system that works well enough, and it would just create too many problems no one really wants to deal with in terms of digitizing all of this centrally with governments.
Yeah, it might just be too technically difficult. It might just be something that they can't do. I mean, I think in general, the utopianism of European politicians especially is falling apart. America seems to be reinventing itself or trying to reinvent itself politically, where, and this is, I think, something that's become even more obvious, even more stark this year than before. The EU elites, I mean, I think of someone like Ursula von der Leyen, they talk a good game in a way. They're very arrogant. They're very smug. But it seems like they really can't achieve anything anymore. It seems like they're really out at sea, not just with Trump, just with the world in general. It seems like things are spiraling out of their control. And definitely their utopian schemes, I think, are just, I mean, I guess they're thinking, well, they'll save us. It's the utopianism that'll save us. But I don't see it. It seems like this is all destined to fall apart.
Yeah, there's just nothing really going for the EU. You know, again, no more than the talking about the Conservative parties. It's like, what even economically is there at this point? Because prior to the Great Recession in 2008-09, I mean, the EU and the US were kind of neck and neck economically, and a lot of economists in the 2000s would have made a case that actually the EU is going to pass out the US in a number of ways. But I mean, look at the last 10, 15 years. It's you know, it's stagnation. It's some of these southern European countries, you have like youth unemployment of 50%. You look at where the growth is coming from now, and you look at like the dominant economic actors, even privately, and you know, who is it? It's like Google and Nvidia and Microsoft, and you know, it's all of these American companies, and increasingly a lot of Chinese manufacturing companies, Chinese tech companies. You know, you go through like innovation in electric vehicles or any new emerging tech, AI. And it's just like Europe just doesn't seem to figure in any of this stuff. It's like, what happened to the EU? You know, on paper, the population size, skilled workforce, you know, high IQ populations, infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just stagnation. Yeah. And, you know, you can see that the political backlash is there in terms of opposition to the EU growing, protests, opposition coming from groups like farmers, I think increasingly from other areas of the economy as well. But yeah, the EU has just been so uninspired. I mean, even the response to the financial crisis, it's like, you know, the EU, it kind of like it wants to be this federal super state that has its own central bank and can just, you know, juice money into an economy if it's in trouble. But then it also, it's kind of midway between that and this like confederal thing where it has, you know, you have kind of an integrated economic system, which you also don't. So you kind of get the worst effects of everything. Like if a country is in financial trouble and maybe needs an economic stimulus, like the European Central Bank can't do that. But then they can enforce like little regulations to stop countries getting into too much debt to protect the euro currency for Germany. It's just all, it's all like quite small little tweaks and technicalities designed to ensure stability. But it's like, you know, the US has the power to just, you know, juice up Silicon Valley. You know, like the US military basically created Silicon Valley. Like, none of those companies turned a profit. They were built basically because they needed chips for missiles, and they needed all sorts of tech to compete in the Cold War. And so they funded these tech companies to run at a loss for decades, and then it became commercially viable as they achieved so much innovation in chip making and so on. But it's like, yeah, the EU, you know, it doesn't operate on that level in terms of like, okay, we want to win the AI race, or we want to be competitors in this new market. We're going to do this big investment program in this. They can't do that. They don't have the political support to do that. But then also you still get like the annoying kinds of petty constraints on entrepreneurship. It's like the worst of both worlds. You know, the only kind of fix they had to the Great Recession was like they just imposed rules on states that they can't run deficits at a certain level, which again was just like protect the stability of the euro for Germany. But now it's like 15 years later, and it's like, you know, a lost decade going on two decades has been passed out by the US. China has passed it out in many regards, and yeah, there's no vision there. I mean, there's just you know, even the people, at least people that would just go like full federal Europe, like let's just have a big central bank and just juice Europe and go to space and build massive AI centers. I mean, at least that's something, right? That's a vision. You know, the nationalists that say, let's just abolish the EU and just have you know, individual countries try and make their way in these things and adopt different policies. That's a vision. But the current version of the EU, it's like there isn't even a vision there. It's like, well, you know, the promise of the EU is like, we'll give you a pretty like competent technocracy that will, you know, it'll regulate things like the, you know, having a universal charging plug and you know, cutting down on waste and bottle caps. And economically, we like won't have a country get into 200% of its GDP debt. So you won't have hyperinflation. Like, in terms of any vision beyond that of like, we'll basically run things as they've been, there's just absolutely nothing there. And, you know, it's hard to see how you reform that as well, because, you know, if you politically have some great federal vision or something, well, okay, well, how are you going to implement that in terms of selling into national politics? And then if you want to reform in the other direction, well, it's going to be like a nationalist opposition to the EU. So it's hard to see where there's any space for some real alternative vision of what European unity could do economically or culturally. It's hard to see how that emerges or gets any kind of platform.
Yeah, and I think that you make a good point that it's basically a lack of vision, but also a lack of, what's the word, locus. The EU, and that's baked into the EU, that it's not specific to any one nation, and indeed that it's, to a great extent, it's anti-nation, it's anti-borders, it's globalistic. Well, you can sort of get away with that when you have a vision for the future or something to distract people from their nations, but it doesn't. So people naturally start thinking, well, what about what about Germany? What about Sweden? What about France? What about the things that we care about? And so again, you come back to this. I'm not saying that therefore the resurgence of nationalism is inevitable. I'm just saying that it obviously provides an obvious answer, an obvious alternative to the bland grandiosity of the EU, which is really nondescript, but so full of itself and yet achieving nothing. So people, I think, I can understand why ordinary people would start to think, well, let's start from home. Let's start from our own countries. Let's build something up. Let's make something that's worth protecting, that's worth caring about, because your huge grand system means nothing to me. means nothing to, and it doesn't enrich me either. See, again, you can get away with that kind of stuff if it puts bread on the table, but it doesn't. So I think the natural thing to happen here is a return to things that are tangible.
Yeah, one of the nefarious aspects of that as well is, like, because there's no vision, or because there's no, like you said, like, central locus where you could even carry this out, or, you know, what would that even look like? Increasingly, the way they make their change is, like, it's like, okay, we're not having some big European election where, like, you vote in, you know, whatever the left or the right European technocrat, and they run the EU for 4 years and just taking their vision. It's like, all the changes made incrementally through law. And so you just get this mountain of EU law, and increasingly human rights law, of, like, you know, they can't just be like, okay, von der Leyen's in charge now, and, you know, every country has to do this, this, and this, and immigration. So it's like, instead you get, like, the European Convention on Human Rights, and, you know, suddenly you wake up one day and it's like, well, actually, you can't deport that guy that washed up on your shores from Pakistan, because according to the ECHR that you signed up to, you have to, like, give him a lawyer and send him through, like, a 5-year process of hearing out his case and making sure you didn't breach his human rights at any step along the way, and, you know, you filed all the paperwork on time. And, you know, if you breach this at any point, not only does he stay in the country, but it turns out you owe him, like, you know, you owe him $500,000 because you breached his human rights. It's like, all of that has come very incrementally through law, but, like, that's also, like, the only way the EU really has to move things in any direction. So, yeah, it just becomes a way to kind of stifle national governments, stifle populism, and, you know, just send things in a direction. And then, of course, it's, you know, it's the NGOs and the Europhile activists that then actually carry that out. But the EU is just there in this way to kind of, you know, set those incentives and kind of place limits on people that oppose them politically. But yeah, it doesn't send anything in a positive direction in terms of something that would benefit people's lives. I mean, I had this debate recently with Martin Selner and some of the other people that were talking about this. I mean, I wrote a couple of pieces saying it wouldn't be wise for us to go in on let's abolish the EU, because I just think the political capital required for that, it's like, in most European countries, even where you have a strong populist party, it's still like 2/3 to 3/4 want to stay in the EU. So not only do you have to convince the general public, you also have the majority of your existing supporters against you. And, you know, at a time where it's like you have pro-remigration parties on 20-30% in European countries, like, do you really want to go all in on a position that, like, 90% of your country is totally opposed to? So, my main argument was, you know, if you generated the coalition that would be required to abolish the EU, which is, like, you know, nationalist governments in Germany and France and elsewhere, at that point, you would have the political capital necessary to just reform the EU, basically, in whatever direction you want. And even the people that are for abolishing the EU, I mean, most of them say, like, yeah, we're going to have some kind of European Union after, like, where all the nationalist groups will come together and build, like, a new European confederation that doesn't have the negative elements of the EU. But then at that point, it's like, you know, it would be like a years long, if not decades long process, like, undoing all of the, you know, the laws and the economic agreements and, you know, all of these overlapping systems that the EU has created. It would be hugely costly politically, economic effects. It would lose public support. So I think I really think the only answer is just, you know, as well as having the growth of national populist movements and pushing things back in our own country, that we have some kind of general sense as well of where things go on the continent level. In the same way, I don't think the left had, like, a plan of, like, by, you know, by 2025 we'll have human rights law and, like, you know, NGOs bringing thousands of invaders into Europe. In the same way, like, if we can agree on some kind of basic fundamentals of what the EU should be or could be, I think we could push it in that direction if you get nationalist governments. because, yeah, it's bleak when you think about the EU, because I don't think it's viable to abolish it. And I think it was kind of blackpilling as well what happened with Brexit, in terms of it drags on for years. People keep going back, electing Conservatives, and it gives them years of political capital. The effect on immigration is like fewer European migrants and record net migration. And now all the migrants are like non-white, non-European. And, you know, that position itself became unpopular, in terms of if there was a vote now, it would be to rejoin the EU. So there's a lot of things against going in that direction. Like I wouldn't say it was the wrong move for people to have voted for Brexit necessarily, but I think that path is kind of closed now, and I think we're going to have to think of a different direction things go in.
All right. I wasn't expecting that. But yeah, I can see what you mean. I don't know. I mean, Brexit to some extent was an illusion, because it seems like the same systems continue anyway, one way or another. Here's a different topic that I wanted to ask you about. The last time you were on Millennial, you and I were both saying, and this is from memory, so I might get it wrong, but the gist of it was that, and this gets us to Israel and Gaza and so on, and the gist of what we said was that there's going to be a huge contradiction for the Israeli lobby, the Jewish lobby, to be advocating, let's say, mass killing in Gaza, but then lecturing the Gentile public in Europe and America that they shouldn't be racist, and that, you know, talking about microaggressions and berating us for this, that, and the other, and so on. And you and I were both saying, like, how are they going to justify this when the Israelis are being, you could say, extremely racist, basically wiping out or apparently wiping out an ethnic group. And I think that we were actually correct about that, because the last 2 years, that was 2 years ago, has seen Israel really struggling, or not even Israel, Jews in the West really struggling to, and the most obvious example of this is just recently, I've forgotten his name, Daniel Finkelstein, really struggling to justify being a Zionist, whilst also saying that, you know, it's a civic identity in Britain, in Western countries. They cannot be ethnostates. They must never be ethnostates. And so this contradiction, this hypocrisy, has been brought to the fore exactly as you and I thought it would be. So 2 years on, what would you say about the standing of Israel internationally, and of Jewish lobbyists within the West in terms of their credibility, all of that?
Yeah, it's at an all-time low. I guess it's gotten worse every point after October 7th. The backlash, I could maybe say it's been bigger than even I expected, in terms of, you know, Tucker Carlson and Candace Owens, like, the stuff they say now is just, like, unbelievable a few years ago, in terms of talking about, basically openly talking about, like, Jewish control of the United States and you know, all the kind of red pills on Israeli influence and the Zionist lobby and so on. So, yeah, it has been quite something. And, I mean, they've been flailing around looking for a way to sell the project to a new audience. And it's almost surprising, for all their competence, how badly that's failed in the last few years. You know, I'm thinking of some of the influencers they've rolled out. Like, well, like for the GOP, they had this guy like Shabbos Kestenbaum, who his thing was like he's a Democrat, but he doesn't think the Democrats are sufficiently pro-Jewish. So then he spoke at their convention, and then like 2 weeks later, he was like back on a left-wing podcast. It was like, you know, you just have all these weird figures that just don't appeal to anyone. And they kind of made this appeal to right-wingers of like, oh, you know, we're fighting the same battle. And You know, your struggle is our struggle, but it just doesn't, it didn't land. It's like, at the same time, you have politicians in Israel, multiple government politicians, saying we should send the people of Gaza to live in Europe. This would be a great opportunity for Europe. You know, this was an opinion piece one of their ministers wrote in the Financial Times about how much Europe would benefit from this. And you regularly have politicians saying European countries deserve this as punishment for opposing in Israel. So it's like all of these messages are, you know, they're not very compatible with one another. And you hear this all the time, but Israel is funding like Gen Z influencers to help their PR. I mean, if they are, I don't really see them. Like, it doesn't seem like they're getting much traction. They do seem to have funded some of these just like gutter kind of conservative shills. Like, there's this like gay black guy that like travels to Israel and like wears IDF shirts and tries to sell to conservative audience. It's just, yeah, none of it lands. There's nothing organic there. And they basically have lost the capacity to justify it. I mean, the news today was Belgium is joining South Africa's genocide case against Israel, which is, you know, obviously hugely significant seat of the EU and so on. So yeah, I mean, it's been more of the same. It's been loss of support from former supporters, people like Piers Morgan, very mainstream people, basically a mainstreaming of the critiques of the Israel lobby and Zionist influence, all of the stuff that would have gotten people like Mir Shimer, some of the people that wrote about the Israel lobby 10-15 years ago, cancelled. It's like every leftist influencer knows that stuff by heart now, and increasingly on the right as well. And any, you know, even though the Republican Party is still very Zionist, I mean, you have all of these outsider figures like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Gates and Tucker and all these people that are very much counter to that. And increasingly, even people that support it have to kind of wash it through this promise of America First or qualified support. I mean, Vance, you can tell, knows how toxic that issue is politically, and I think it'll be interesting to see how he navigates that when he runs for president. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to see a way back for them. I think that's why they've kind of rushed this in terms of trying to achieve all of their strategic objectives of like, okay, we're not going to be able to count on Western support in the future. They desperately need US support, and that's crumbling. If you look at the opinion polls, it hasn't, again, translated politically yet, but it really seems like a matter of time. When you lose the public that badly, okay, you know, you might have a generation of politicians still with you, but I think in the long run that has to translate politically. You know, there's so much political capital there. Like, it basically became the number one issue for the left across the West, across the world in the last couple of years. I don't think that's going to be forgotten, and the issue isn't going to go away either. So they seem to be taking this posture increasingly of, let's just aggressively achieve the military aims, burn the international credibility that was on the decline anyway. So, you know, you make your plan now while you still can count on U.S. support, and you have Trump, who's, you know, massively supportive, and you can achieve these maximalist aims. And then, okay, 20, 30 years when you have President Mamdani and the U.S. is opposed to this stuff, well, okay, you know, at that point, the West Bank is annexed and, you know, maybe Hezbollah is decapitated and Iran has a, you know, has a liberal government or something, then it's not really a problem. And I think they're even moving in the direction in terms of the discourse of accepting, like, U.S. aid isn't going to be a permanent thing, and they're going to establish permanent security structures that can maintain the state on its own. So yeah, they've torched their credibility. Is it the end of the Israeli state, as some people were all excited about a couple of years ago? No, I think they're pretty secure right now. But in terms of the, you know, the prevalence of Zionism in the political conversation in the West, I think that's increasingly dead. And it still exists to a degree on the right. You know, you have these propped up figures that kind of stepped into the void, you know, the Constantine Kissens or these kinds of people that suddenly pop up on YouTube with huge followings and keep that around on the right. But I think even they will be dragged into a kind of negotiated position of it's no benefit to the right. The left make political capital with it, and the right eventually will find a position that the kind of mainstream right people accept of you know, taking a outward, explicit kind of, you know, America first or nationalist position if it's in Europe, and putting that issue to the side. So yeah, I really don't see a way back for them.
Yeah, no, neither do I. Yeah, I think it's been fascinating to watch it happen, and just their incompetence, their inability to fight against it and to stop it, because the footage, the pictures coming out of Gaza are just appalling, and I think it becomes very, not just difficult for people to defend it, but gross for people to, like, just unseemly for people to defend it. So I think they've really not helped themselves, but by appearing so belligerent and bloodthirsty. I mean, I'm talking about Netanyahu's government here. But of course, that reflects on Israel as a whole, which then reflects on the Jewish diaspora, who are the ones who have to defend it abroad. And I think it's not an enviable task. I think the point generally is that this again changes the debate and again means that we're in a transitional moment. So, all right. Well, this has been a fantastic discussion, Keith. It's mainly been you talking and me asking questions, of course, but it's been very interesting. So thank you. I'll get to the super chats now. And there are just a few of them. The Thin Red Line said, "Thank you for all your work, Woz. It is great to hear from Keith again." Well, thank you very much. And he asks about some other people, but unfortunately I'm not on good terms with them, so I'm going to leave it at that. Stephen said, "The reason for lefty sociologists, 2/3 of core paradigms come from Marx or are needed to make Marxism work. Conflict theory, social constructionism, and they're all terrible at math and love lefty culture." Do you have anything to say about
that?
Yeah,
that's true. It is. It's very Marxist. It's very Marxist inspired. A lot of the theories rely on Marxist premises, but I don't know. Does that explain it? Because that's kind of a chicken and egg thing. It's like, yeah, the theories are Marxist because, like, loads of Marxists go into sociology and fill it up with Marxism, right? But it's still... still the question of, like, why is it so full of lefties? But yeah, I think it's you know, personality type of the kind of person that becomes an academic in the social sciences.
Yeah, it might also be that there's an element of, it's only in a hard left environment like that that you can actually get away with saying things that are very potentially very right wing, because you've got the cover of the environment of the leftism, but then the environment won't make use of your research because it's got no use for it. It's not Marxist. Okay, and Australian Drew says, "Thank you, Keith, for all your great work this year. Is there another Woodstown episode in the new year?"
Maybe. There's always the possibility of a reunion show. It's much sought after all. You know, we still have a cult fan base, so maybe I'll have to bring it back.
All right. Salty Linus says, "Thanks, Woz, for all the hard work of putting this together every year. It's introduced me to a lot of people I might never have found without you. Thank you, God bless, and Merry Christmas." Well, thank you very much, Salty, and Merry Christmas to you as well. And I'm glad that this is of use to you. Armchair Limerick Nationalist says, "Merry Christmas, Woz and Keith. Does Keith think that Ireland will leave the EU in the near future? And will it make any difference with regard to immigration, considering the nothing burger with Brexit?"
No, it's a short answer. I mean, I think Ireland is probably the most pro-EU country in Europe. Like, it consistently polls at over 90% positive towards the EU. So, no, there's no realistic chance of that happening. And would it change anything with immigration? I mean, the problem with immigration here is, you know, really rests with their own government in terms of aggressively importing hundreds of thousands of people the largest group now is Indians and other South Asians, and that's, you know, that's not an EU free movement thing. That is our government choosing to import them, much like the UK has done since it left the EU. So I don't think it's even really a beneficial thing to focus on in Ireland right now. I'd much rather keep the focus on and the blame on our government for that issue.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's the same in Britain. They can't blame the EU for that anymore. So, they blame the European Court of Human Rights to an extent, but even that I don't see as a final answer, because you can leave that, and that's what we should do. So we've got to hold our governments responsible for this. Okay, Safe Western Civ says, Merry Christmas. Well, Merry Christmas to you as well. All right. I'll end this one here. This has been a great discussion, so thank you, Keith. Is there anything you'd like to tell? Yeah, thank you. Is there anything you'd like to tell people before we finish, just where they can find you?
I guess I'll just do a plug before I go. Last month I've been working on this project, Europa.com, which is, we're working to build basically a nationalist alternative to Drudge Report, you know, a nationalist aggregator. So we've got a few people working on it now, and we're pretty consistently covering the news. We're doing like 100 to 150 headlines a day. Eventually we want to have versions for other countries in Europe outside of the English language. We recently got our gold badge on X, so if you're watching there, you can follow us. It's just at Europa. And I'm excited. I don't think there's been a project like this before in nationalism, but I think it has huge potential. Could be a great, it's a great value add for nationalists to follow the news, especially now with social media being so full of AI slop and fake news. It's increasingly hard to tell what's even real. But also I think it'll help bring a lot of people outside our fold into it and encounter nationalist voices. You know, we post stuff from all different nationalist websites and blogs and Substacks, as well as covering the whatever the big news of the day is. So yeah, europa.com. I'm excited to see a lot of growth for that in the next year.
Okay, excellent. I hope people can check that out. And yeah, maybe representatives from it could appear on Millennial next year. We'll see.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, well, I'll be back very soon with the next guest. But in the meantime, Keith Woods, thank you for appearing on Millennial 2025. And thank you for saving me tonight. So I'm very grateful.
All right. Merry Christmas, everyone.
Merry Christmas.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. How about helping your tireless host? T-shirts, mugs, and posters are available in the merchandise store. The perfect way to remember this unique time. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the fire burning.